From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today the campaign trail goes south of the border. Donald Trump meeting with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto ahead of his speech tonight in Phoenix on immigration. Hillary Clinton, meanwhile, will be in the swing states of Ohio and Pennsylvania before heading to a fundraiser in Washington.
And as we continue to follow the presidential race, we're also watching races for the House and the Senate, which brings us to North Carolina and today's Senate tracker. Joining us now to talk about that race is Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief at WUNC. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Jeremy.
And the Republican incumbent in this race is Senator Richard Burr, who, by the way, is, I didn't know this, distantly related to Aaron Burr. And he has been pretty popular over the course of his two terms in the Senate. How did this race get so tight?
Well, we also should note five terms in the U.S. House. So this is a 22-year incumbent in Congress. How did it get close? Probably boils down to three different things. I mean, there are many factors, but the Trump factor is one. And this unpopular GOP nominee for president has hurt Burr to some degree. There's a tight governor's race here as well. And I think that is a factor in this. There's a Republican incumbent, but there's a strong Democratic challenger to the governor here in North Carolina. And there's also the factor of money. I've chatted with several strategists, but a couple have noted that Deborah Ross, the challenger to the incumbent Richard Burr, did very well fundraising and spent a decent chunk of that early on television ads. She's a former state legislator, so that helped her kind of raise name recognition and, to some extent, bolstered her campaign.
Well, let me go into some of the things that you just said there. First of all, is Burr supporting Trump?
Burr is supporting Trump. It's a delicate balance for him because, as I said, two decades plus in Congress, he's been a good Republican. He's been a party line guy and has done what the Republican Party has needed him to do. You know, he's ascended to chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And it was interesting. I spoke with Senator back in May at the state Republican convention, and he gave a speech. He came off stage and said, as part of the speech, you know, that he supported Trump. So we asked him, we said, you know, that was, you know, one of the first times publicly you had mentioned Mr. Trump. You know, how do you feel about him? And he said, well, I think that Donald Trump is Hillary Clinton's worst nightmare. And we followed up with, so does that mean you'll be campaigning with him this fall? And he kind of wryly looked at us, you know, a hidden smile and said, well, I think I'll stick to my own campaign events.
What about the ads that are running? I want to listen to one here. This is from the Burr campaign. It features an African-American pastor, Kirby Jones of Raleigh, speaking in support of Burr.
Richard has done a great deal to help the children and their families get on a path and a trajectory that leads to academic success and life success. He is genuinely interested in our community, in our children. Thank you, Richard Burr, for helping the families and children of North Carolina.
So he's going after African-American voters in that ad. How much support does he get from people who may otherwise vote Democratic in North Carolina?
Well, he gets more than Donald Trump, but at this point, it's not clear if Senator Burr has enough, gets enough to win this election with Deborah Ross. And with changes to the voting law and election law here in recent months and recent years, the African-American vote is very important and is something that obviously he's making a play for in this advertisement to some degree.
What should we know about Deborah Ross?
She's a former state legislator in North Carolina. She's a former state head of the ACLU. And one of the concerns strategists and political scientists feel that she had when she entered the race and still to some degree has now is this notion that she's too left, that she's a little too liberal in a state that is pretty purple. You know, I mean, the demographics in North Carolina are changing. This is a state that voted for the Republican nominee for seven consecutive elections.
Right.
And then with President Obama, then senator, 2008 and running for re-election 2012, it was one of the closest presidential races in the country. So it has swung here in North Carolina, but there are some concerns about her electability on a statewide race. But as I mentioned before, she's done very well in the fundraising aspect of this campaign. She's brought a great level of energy and enthusiasm. And, you know, as is often the case, and as we're seeing with other challenges to first-term Republicans or second-term Republicans in the U.S. Senate, she's framing this as, you know, she's an outsider. She's going to right the ship. She's going to bring some order and semblance to Washington. Nothing new there.
And I remember in a previous North Carolina Senate campaign, your former Democratic Senator Kay Hagan, who lost her race, was really under pressure to decide how much she wanted to tie herself to President Obama and to Obamacare. Is Deborah Ross tying herself to Hillary Clinton?
It's an interesting question because for so long, candidates running for statewide office here have had to be careful about how closely they tether themselves to a national candidate. I was at an event a few weeks ago with Tim Kaine, you know, the vice presidential nominee, called out Deborah Ross, pointed to her, and she got a standing ovation. So I think that she has aligned herself fairly closely with some of Clinton's policies and with some of the visits that she and, you know, the vice presidential candidate and some of her surrogates have made to the state in recent weeks.
Well, let's listen to an attack ad that she put out on Senator Burr last week. This is set up as a phone call between the two candidates.
Hello?
Deborah.
Senator?
Listen, you gotta stop saying Washington's not working.
Just telling the truth.
But it's working just fine for me.
Oh, sure. You took millions from special interests.
Uh-huh.
Went there and cashed in.
Your point?
Voted to cut your own taxes and raise taxes on working folks.
That's how Washington works.
Well, it's working just fine.
So she's really trying to tie him to a Washington that's broken.
She is. And this is a year of the outsider. And I think that to some extent, at least as of now, 2+ months before Election Day, it has worked for her to some extent. She's really increased that name recognition. She was trailing in the polls earlier this year. We're talking 8, 10, 12 points. That's not the case anymore. And, you know, some of the framework of this messaging appears to be working.
That's Jeff Tiberi, who is Capital Bureau Chief at WUNC, joining us from Durham, North Carolina, to talk about the Senate race in that state. We'll be watching. Jeff, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, the Phoenix City Council votes today on whether to issue municipal ID cards to city residents. If the vote passes, Phoenix will join a growing number of cities in the U.S. that offer photo IDs that can be used by people who don't have other options, people like the elderly who don't drive or immigrants. The move is being celebrated by immigration rights groups who say the IDs would also improve interactions with police. But as Carrie Young reports from Here and Now contributor KJZZ, the idea has some vocal opponents as well.
When Eduardo Pym isn't working, chances are you'll find him doing something creative.
So this is the space here. This is the shirt press here. And those are poster presses.
Pym is an artist, and this screen printing studio is almost like a second home to him. While Pym does have a day job, his design work brings in the occasional paycheck too. But actually cashing those checks is a challenge.
At the bank, they're asking for a state ID, which I didn't have. And they wouldn't take my school ID.
Pym grew up in Phoenix, but he's undocumented, so he can't qualify for that state-issued ID the bank was demanding, meaning he often has to go to a local liquor store that cashes checks.
Sometimes it's a little sketchy. Sometimes it feels like I'm in purgatory.
Not having an ID impacts more than just his finances. Most landlords require a state ID to rent an apartment. And for parents in Pym's position, not having an ID can mean they're not allowed inside their child's school for things like teacher conferences.
Community members asked if we could do a state identification, if we could do a license. And looking at the political makeup of the state, we were like, no, we can't do that right now.
Betty Diana Hernandez is the executive director for the Center for Neighborhood Leadership, one of several organizations supporting the development of a municipal ID. The coalition, known as One Phoenix ID, introduced the local ID idea to the city council more than 2 years ago. They say other groups that also have trouble obtaining state IDs, like the homeless and the elderly, could benefit too.
If this identification card will not be actually respected by everyone within the city, including the Phoenix Police Department, then it would be useless, right? Because one of the biggest factors has been people not calling police because they're scared to interact because the first question is, you know, let me see your ID.
The city also hopes to integrate the card with services like the library and light rail. And organizers are working to get museums and other cultural locations to offer discounts for cardholders. The measure has strong support, but there are some vocal opponents, too, including Phoenix Councilman Jim Waring.
Bottom line, we're spending a lot of taxpayer time and money. Again, it's a serious problem, but this card is going to do absolutely nothing to solve it. And in a state that has high rates of identity theft, should we really be throwing a card out there with potentially the City of Phoenix logo?
The One Phoenix ID Coalition insists the card will be cost neutral, paid for with card fees. Local nonprofit groups have also pledged to help with administrative operations, but Waring isn't buying it.
This is a federal government issue. The City of Phoenix City Council is not the group that really should be addressing it. I understand political pressure is driving this.
Municipal ID programs are already up and running in other large cities, including Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York City. In New York, more than 863,000 people have one. Half say it's their primary form of ID, and they use it for a variety of reasons, including getting into a museum. The city has run into some roadblocks. Many major banks don't accept them. Still, thousands report they've successfully opened a bank account using the ID. But even if this measure passes Phoenix City Council today, it still faces challenges from some Arizona lawmakers who say it would encourage illegal immigration. One state senator says he'll work to pass a bill that would force the program to shut down. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Young in Phoenix.
Question: are vegetables the victims of bad marketing? Is it possible that if you simply dress up a zucchini as a super surfer dude named Zachy, kids will eat more zucchini? And if you play videos and display banners about him and Colby Carrot and Susie Sweet Pea, you can get kids in school cafeterias to triple their visits to the salad bar. Well, a study recently published in the journal Pediatrics concludes, yes. It was conducted by researchers from the Centers for Behavioral Economics and Child Nutrition at Cornell. It took place in 10 elementary schools over a six-week period. Drew Hanks is lead author of the study. He's now a professor of consumer sciences at Ohio State University and joins us from there. Professor Hanks, you worked with a group called Super Sprouts. They provided you with the advertising materials. Tell us what you did.
Sure. We entered into these cafeterias, and we had one group that made no changes in their cafeterias. We used as the baseline group. Mm-hmm. And then one group, we actually went in and put these vinyl banners around the base of the salad bar. Another group of schools, we had flat screen televisions playing reels of these characters talking about nutrition, talking about health, talking about proper eating. And then in another set of schools, we had vinyl banners around the salad bars as well as the flat screen televisions in the cafeterias.
And when you say vinyl banners, these were banners that had all the characters, you know, the action characters on them.
That's right, exactly. Right. So we collected baseline data for 2 weeks and then put these interventions in for 4 weeks. And over that four-week period, we saw in schools that had both the vinyl banners and the flat screen televisions, 240% more kids were taking vegetables as part of their lunch. And in schools where just the vinyl banners were fastened around the base of the salad bars, just over 90% of the kids were taking vegetables as part of their lunch. So we saw a great impact on getting kids to take more vegetables as part of their school lunch by doing these fairly simple marketing strategies in the cafeterias.
The same kind of strategies that are applied to fast foods and processed foods.
Sure, sure. And what I think is really powerful about this study is that, you know, while it is focused on, you know, elementary schools, some of the implications we can think about can be useful in many different settings. Just like in grocery stores or in certain restaurants, marketing can have an impact on what we choose. It can have the same impact in school cafeterias.
On kids, but I have a question for you. So they
Sure.
took the vegetables at the salad bars. Did Mm-hmm. they eat them?
That is one of the golden questions in this research, and unfortunately, we weren't able to answer that question. But some of our previous research from the center does indicate that a student is actually more likely to eat the food in front of them if they take it of their own choice. And so the fact that we had a bunch of kids going to the salad bars and taking more vegetables, consider that they'll be eating more than they would have if it was forced on their tray.
Right, right. It's their choice. Well, in some of the reading, there's a quote from a 10-year-old who's sitting there absentmindedly eating some veggies while he watches the videos on the flat-screen TVs. And he says, well, the ads make it look better, but sometimes it's not. So, you know, the other thing is, what about the long-term effect of this?
It's a great question also. And when we think about marketing, we often think of a novelty effect. And so it could be that, you know, this is a short-term impact. And some recent research I've been doing suggests that we might need to, you know, kind of refresh that intervention somewhere along the way to make it new again. Marketing in and of itself, I don't think is bad. What I think we can really consider is how can we leverage the knowledge that we have through, you know, consumer behavior, through marketing to benefit our society, to benefit us in terms of eating healthy. And so I think this provides just a very, very small glimpse into a great window of opportunity for understanding this better.
Well, it also shows how powerful advertising is. We're reading that in Canada, the health minister there is, you know, saying because there's evidence that's shown marketing unhealthy products influences child obesity, the federal government there is going to introduce new restrictions on commercial marketing to help families make better choices. So the government's actually going to intervene there. Drew Hanks, professor of consumer sciences at Ohio State University, his study when he was at Cornell on the effects of marketing vegetables to school children. If a teacher or a principal is hearing this now, what's one thing that they can do in the new school year?
Yeah, I think what they can do is work with their school cafeteria staff to make the fruits and vegetables on the lunch line a little more attractive. You know, if they aren't able to get a hold of these vinyl banners or flat screen televisions, provide descriptive and fun names for the vegetables on the lunch line, or put the fruit in a nice, attractive bowl in several locations on the lunch line so that kids think it looks nice, right? And when it looks better, we think it might even taste better.
Professor Hanks, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Malcolm Gladwell recently started a food fight over what older kids are eating at college. He said on his podcast, Revisionist History, that the dining program at Maine's Bowdoin College presented a moral problem because the food is some of the best anywhere, sushi and lobster and orzo and tofu salad. Gladwell says high-end spending on dining means less spending on financial aid. He quoted the president of Vassar, who said, yes, her school's food was pretty mediocre. Some students had worse words for it. But she said it's because they choose to spend their money on aid for low-income students. Well, Bowdoin was furious. They lashed back. They called Gladwell's analysis dishonest, disingenuous. For one thing, they said the spending on dining does not come from financial aid. Dining operations are self-supporting. They're paid for by students' fees. Well, nonetheless, Gladwell says, don't let your kid and your friends go to Bowdoin. Don't give money to Bowdoin or any other school that serves amazing food in its dining hall. Let's check in with one. Frank Turkin is the executive chef at the University of Michigan's Ann Arbor campus. He's a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America. He ran the kitchens in some of Detroit's best restaurants and private clubs. He joins us from Michigan Radio, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. And Chef Turkin, what do you think of this smackdown by Malcolm Gladwell, this accusation that great college dining is a moral problem?
You know, funny thing is, at the University of Michigan, we look at it as a health issue, health nutrition. We're like right in the middle in the Big Ten. So he's talking about private schools. We're a public school. We're trying to, you know, be good stewards of students' money. Mm-hmm. We don't serve lobster. You know, we look at the cost. We look at the bigger buys. We have a better understanding. So we're really more aware of the students' money and the sustainability and being good stewards of it.
Well, and you're right there in a little bit of a food capital there in the Midwest. When I think of Ann Arbor, I think of Zingerman's and great food. But what is it that you're trying to do? Like, to give us a sense of some of the meals that you're trying to bring to the students.
Well, what we're trying to bring is we have, you know, 9 different dining halls on campus, and each one's unique and different. We have one hall that's just sustainable. So it supports our local farmers, local fishermen, cattlemen. Also, at South Quad, we have 10 micro-restaurants. And what I call micro-restaurants is to help with the food costs or the extra spend, we actually look at the waste, meaning we look at the portion sizes. We look at what actually students are not eating so we can keep an eye on the cost. But talking about the food, I mean, we have a barbecue. We use a tougher cut of meat, and we cook it for a slower time, so the cost of savings there. We do have a sushi bar, but, you know, again, it's rice and simple products. So it might sound expensive, but the way we present it and the way we serve it gives it that value added.
Well, talk a little bit about the waste. So how do you do that? How do you control waste? I mean, you know, are they ladling out the food themselves or are you?
No, we are. We actually, about 5 years ago, developed a concept, and we call it the complete plate. We put the vegetables, we put the starch on, we put the protein on. We've cut our proteins down from 6-4 ounces, like our traditional, down to a 2-3 ounce. And we've increased our vegetables, increased our starches, our rice, our beans, to give students a healthier portion. With a place like South Quad, we have 10 micro-restaurants. If a student went through and had, you know, 5 of those and had 4-ounce portions, you know, that's 20 ounces of meat. That's almost 2 pounds. And I don't think they're going to consume it. They're going to throw it away. So we've set up a smaller portion so students, if they want more, they can come back and ask. So it's set up a tasting way, is that way.
Well, you know, this whole movement has been going on for decades. Sometimes it's for young people. It's the first time they're living away from home and they're just going to live on junk food. And, you know, you talk about the freshman 15, the 15 pounds that they'll gain in their right. in their freshman year. This has been going on for a while to try to move away from that. Is that a part of it, too? I mean, you mentioned health.
Oh, it's very important. The health part is, you know, we're trying to get away from the freshman 15. The students are coming to us now are more educated in health, more knowledgeable than our parents were, people before us. I mean, so they're driving the bus on nutrition. You know, we have dietitians on staff. The big thing, too, is also we have to keep in mind is one thing that we focus on at the University of Michigan is allergies, which is something that's exploding over the years. So we're serving more fish this year. That's one of the big things we do. We serve fish more than the red meat. We've decreased our portion sizes. Our dietitians work with all that.
Well, it's just so interesting. Look, we started off talking about a food fight. We'll put that aside to say you have a lot more things to think about mm-hmm. in college dining rooms, it sounds like.
Correct. I mean, actually, today is the day of first day of move-in. Once parents leave, I mean, the students are with us. It's our responsibility to feed them breakfast, lunch, and dinner, meals a day, 7 days a week. And we have to give them healthy options. We have to help them. Yes, we do the chicken tenders, chicken nuggets, but we also offer, you know, the grilled chicken breast, turkey burgers, vegan, vegetarian options. We kind of look at the whole spectrum of the diet.
That's Frank Turkin, executive chef at the University of Michigan's Ann Arbor campus. You say it's move-in day there. Bless you. In every college town across America, just let's all be patient.
Yeah, exactly.
Frank, thank you.
Thank you.
The streets are clogged here in Boston. But back to that food fight between Bowden and Malcolm Gladwell, who said that their high-end dining meant less aid for low-income students. Well, according to a breakdown from Inside Higher Education, Bowden's spending on aid is about the same as many other schools, including Oberlin, Swarthmore, Middlebury. So are you a parent or student maybe heading to a dining hall? Today, as you start the new semester, your thoughts on the dining programs on at your schools and how they might dovetail with financial aid.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
And no matter who wins the presidential election, he or she will be among the oldest people ever elected to the presidency. Donald Trump would be the oldest. He's 70. Hillary Clinton is about to be 69. She'd be the second oldest. So it's no surprise that the health of the candidates has come up, which has happened before. Dylan Scott is a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Dylan, in 1984, for instance, Ronald Reagan faced questions about his health after one of the debates. What happened there?
Yeah, so it was one of the first debates in 84 with Walter Mondale, and there was just a lot at the – it was a 90-minute debate, and towards the end, a lot of Democrats and even some news commentators alleged that President Reagan looked old and tired, and obviously at the time, he was one of our oldest presidents. So there was just, again, this sort of – this whisper campaign about how old the president looked, and so the president felt the need to respond and say, you know, questions about my health have been raised before, and I've served for 4 years, and his doctor put out another letter, as is kind of our ritual here in American politics, saying that he was in excellent health.
Yeah, we've seen these letters now coming from the doctors. I don't know if there's any way to actually verify that the doctor is telling you anything other than what they would want their patient to have them tell you during the middle of a presidential campaign. But what about in 1988? The Democratic candidate Michael Dukakis faced a number of questions about his mental health and whether he had a history of depression.
Yes, and I think it has a lot of interesting parallels with the situation we're seeing with Secretary Clinton, where there were these folks on the fringes of conservative media who were circulating rumors and handing out pamphlets at the Democratic convention asking whether Governor Dukakis was a broken man because there were these reports that he'd been unhappy when his brother had died and when he lost re-election. So again, it sort of started out on the fringes, and then once President Reagan kind of made an offhand remark about the governor being an invalid, it became became front page news across the country for about a week. And again, Dukakis felt the need to have his doctor put out another statement reiterating that he was actually in good health. But in my conversation with the governor, he actually thought that those rumors had hurt him.
And then in 1996, in the campaign, when Bill Clinton, who was the incumbent, was running against Bob Dole was 73 years old at the time. How did health play into that race?
Yeah, it's interesting because Senator Dole sort of preemptively put out his full medical records to quash any questions about how he was doing. But then his campaign and the senator himself started to just sort of ask questions about why President Clinton hadn't released his full medical records. What could he possibly be hiding? And again, it was more of sort of a whisper campaign that sort of stayed at the edges of the press coverage at the time. But it was raised enough that it got some coverage in major newspapers. And again, President Clinton didn't really do anything about it. And obviously, he won handily. But it was interesting to see the Dole campaign, of all campaigns, use that tech.
So did you find, as you looked through all of this, that health records make a difference in a presidential campaign, or these questions about health? Or does it seem like whoever is going to win is going to win?
It's hard to say. I did talk to one political scientist who said something interesting about this. He said it's hard to imagine the Hillary Clinton voter who is going to hear these rumors about her health and say, you know what, on that basis alone, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump.
That's Dylan Scott, a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Dylan, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
If you're a fan of open ocean swimming, and there are many hands raised here, you probably know about Lynn Cox. At 16, she set a record for swimming the English Channel. She was also the first person to swim the Strait of Magellan after her 1987 swim in the 38-degree water of the Bering Straits between the U.S. and Soviet territory. Reagan and Gorbachev applauded her. And in 2002, Lynn swam a mile in Antarctica, dodging icebergs with no wetsuit. She's a superwoman, part polar bear. Researchers even studied her because of her resistance to cold.
I swam in 50 degrees Fahrenheit water, 10 degrees centigrade, for 4 hours, and my core temperature increased from my normal temperature of 97.6 degrees Fahrenheit, 36.4 degrees centigrade, to 102 degrees Fahrenheit, 38.8 degrees centigrade. The researchers couldn't believe my results. When people are immersed in 50 degrees Fahrenheit water, 10 degrees centigrade, their core temperature drops, and the longer they stay in the water, the more their temperature drops.
But not Lynn, which is why in 2012, it was devastating when her heart went into atrial fibrillation, 157 beats a minute at rest. Would she need a pacemaker, a new heart? Would she die? Or wait, did she have a broken heart? Lynn Cox's new book is Swimming in the Sink, which, yes, she did, and she joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Lynn, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Start with, you know, when you had this incredible stamina and strength and you were being tested. I mean, how long did you put your hand in ice-cold water? How did it feel?
Oh, actually, that was the test at the University of London, and I had to hold my hand in the ice water for a half an hour. So it was really excruciating, but it was also allowing the doctors to figure out how I was different than the untrained person.
Well, so different that, in fact, your body could raise the temperature of the water around you.
Right. That was one of the funny experiments because that had never happened before. My temperature went up and even the water temperature around me went up by a degree.
Well, and if people are thinking of it, we might as well say it. At one point, the researchers thought you were peeing.
Right. It was crazy. I was like, oh my gosh, I am so embarrassed. But then one of the other scientists said, well, you know, you couldn't pee that volume to be able to warm up the water that much.
Yeah.
It was hysterical.
Well, and you were an elite athlete, and suddenly you're starting to feel tired and run down. You kept thinking what?
I kept wondering what was going on with me because I would, you know, as an athlete, you are aware of your pulse, your heart rate and all that. And I'd feel my pulse and I'd be just like walking across a parking lot and my heart rate was, my normal would be 60 beats per minute. And when I was really in great shape, it'd be 45 beats per minute. So as walking across the parking lot, it was like 100 and 120 and it was really erratic. And I'm thinking, what is going on with me? I don't feel normal. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah. You have friends who were doctors. They're going to enter the stage in a moment. But first, set the scene. A lot of people are going to identify with this. You'd taken care of both of your parents. Then you lost them and your beloved dog. Talk about taking care of your parents.
They were very sick for about 25 years. And I was there for them emotionally, but also physically, taking them to the ER rooms and to the hospitals and being there for their stays. I think one of the most difficult times was when both parents were in the hospital at the same time with life-threatening diseases, and I wasn't sure which one was going to survive or if either one would. But that passed, and they both came out of the hospital, and we started the battles again.
Right. And yet they died. Then you lose this trusty companion. You've written about him in other books, Cody.
Right. Actually, you know, I think that Cody, in a way, was an assistance dog for the family because he was a yellow lab and he was so friendly and happy. And so as they were being sick, Cody would go and sit next to them and keep them company, but also would keep me company. So to have my folks and my dog pass, it was just like everything in my world is going away.
Well, and I know so many men are also the caregivers. We know that. But the majority are women taking care of parents and family. And that's where this becomes something of a cautionary tale, because you're starting to have symptoms and you have a friend, Joe in particular, the fireman, on the phone talking you through it. But at certain points, I'm saying, get up and go to the hospital. What was happening?
Well, my heart was beating at rest at 157 beats per minute, which is really bad. Mm. I mean, it was also beating extremely irregularly. But the problem was that I just didn't want to go to the hospital. I didn't want to admit that there was something really wrong with me. So I thought, well, I'm not feeling good, but maybe if I just go work out, I'll feel better.
Yeah.
And actually, my workout pal, Emmy, just saw me and said, you know, you look really horrible. And so,
because you're dying.
Basically, that's what the doctor found out, that my heart wasn't functioning really at all.
Right.
And it was really interesting because Dr. Oral, my cardiologist, was telling me that when I initially went into the office, I wasn't showing any symptoms of, like, I didn't look like I was having a hard time breathing, and I didn't look like I was having pain in my chest. I wasn't having any pain in my chest, but I didn't look sick.
Well, and at this point, these friends that are doctors, you know, sit you down and say, we've done a lot of research, and we think you have broken heart syndrome. And, you know, we looked it up, Lynn, and it's, there it is, American Heart Association definition. It's stress-induced cardiomyopathy, or Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. And it can happen when you're incredibly healthy, as we presume you were, swimming around in ice-cold water. It can be caused by the death of a loved one, a divorce. You had that.
Right. That's what they figured out. And it was so great because what they basically said is you can completely recover from this. The symptoms for broken heart syndrome can appear to be a heart attack. And so often it's misdiagnosed. And Harvard Health Publishing just came out with a new report, but it tends to happen to women that are between 58 and 72 years old. Happy surprises can also cause this, you know, surprise parties or accidents or prolonged stress. And so it was just like amazing to sort of have your life and your health collapse around you and think that you might have to have a heart transplant and have your heart removed. And then I was talking to Laura King, who's my dermatologist friend, and her partner, her fiance, Charlie Naruga, who was an internist. And they did all this research and came back to me and said, you have this condition and you can fully recover from it. It just takes rest and taking the prescriptions that Dr. Rawls given you and making a way to de-stress your life.
Well, take us through some of that. I mean, here you are again, an elite athlete, suddenly having to slow down, you know, question your heart. You talk directly to your heart. You know, wow, we were in the Bering Straits. What's the deal here? But, you know, trying to take care of yourself. And also that brings us to the title, swimming in the sink, literally standing at a really deep sink and stroking.
I was so sick from the broken heart syndrome that I couldn't get back in the ocean and swim. So the way I was able to get back into the water was to, I didn't really realize what I was doing. I sort of just filled the water in the sink and put in the plug and then started moving my hands. And I thought this was so stupid, but I thought, what the heck? And so then I put on my cap and goggles and started moving my hands back and forth in the sink and suddenly felt that aliveness that you feel when you're doing something that you just love, that gives you joy. And I thought, this is the hope. This is the thing that will help me get back.
Well, it's so interesting. Again, refer back to the woman caregiver that you were for so many decades. As soon as you started really taking care of yourself and slowing down, boom, love walks in the door.
Oh, yes, yes. I think my heart was so connected to my parents and their interests. And once I realized that that chapter of my life was complete and I moved away from all that I knew pretty much, but maintained my friendships, I felt like I started a new life. And because of that, my heart opened up.
How are you doing with a real broken heart?
Well, actually, my heart has mended and it's extremely happy now. And I am doing fantastic. My partner, Stephen Brum from Brenner, helps to create performing arts centers. And so I just love traveling with him and writing and speaking. And I feel like, you know, all this stuff has brought me to this point and now has allowed me to continue to swim, but to do so much more with my life.
Yeah. That's elite athlete Lynn Cox, open ocean swimmer, talking about her new memoir about really an almost near-death experience, a broken heart syndrome. The book is called Swimming in the Sink, an Episode of the Heart. Lynn, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Chicago's police superintendent is moving to fire five police officers involved with the fatal shooting of teenager Laquan McDonald, who was shot 16 times while he walked away from police. Last year, the court ordered release of a video showing the 2014 shooting conflicted with police reports, and that video sparked protests and calls for Mayor Rahm Emanuel to resign. He did not, but he did force out the city's police superintendent. And the news this week about trying to fire the officers involved comes at the end of the deadliest single month that Chicago has seen in nearly 19 years. At least 400 people have been shot in Chicago and at least 78 killed in the city since August 1st. For more, we're joined by Chip Mitchell, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Hi, Chip.
Hello, Jeremy.
And so far this year, if you look at the annual numbers, Chicago has had almost 500 homicides and more than 2,800 people have been shot. That is more than New York and LA combined, and those are much larger cities. What's causing the spike in violence?
Well, the first thing to point out is that on a per capita level, Chicago may lead the nation in absolute numbers in terms of murders, but on a per capita level, there are still a number of cities with higher murder rates. And actually, until this year, we'd gone more than a decade here in Chicago without much change in murders, either increases or decreases. Now, what's causing this? I mean, criminologists try to pinpoint factors behind a surge in murders or a decrease over the years. And in any big city, there's always a lot of debate about this, and it's never clear. Police say here that they're struggling against illegal guns and gang violence. They're calling for a lot more gun control, first off. Some cops, Jeremy, they also say they're afraid any aggressive policing right now might get caught on video, like that Laquan McDonald video, and they'll get in trouble for it. Their careers and even their livelihoods, their liberty is on the line. So some officers say they've gone fetal. That's a term Mayor Emanuel first used to describe the city's policing, Jeremy. And then there's, of course, a lot of mistrust in the police right now, at least since the McDonald video. So the cops maybe aren't getting as much help from residents of the most violent neighborhoods.
And when it comes to gang violence, are the gangs in Chicago different than the gangs in other cities? And does that feed into this?
Well, we have a terrible gang problem here in Chicago, and a couple of things that feed into that is we have extreme racial segregation in this city, affecting mostly the city's black residents and the Latino residents. It's about a third black, a third white, a third Latino, and they are very sharply divided in these neighborhoods, very few integrated neighborhoods. And then we also have a terrible problem with African-American unemployment, affecting mostly young people and especially young black men.
We spoke with Mark Payne today. He's the executive director of violence prevention, this group called Ceasefire. And he said that there's more to the story. Let's listen.
some of the misconception is that it is all gang violence or street organizations that are fighting one another. I think a lot of it is interpersonal, you know, over girls, over minor disputes, over old money.
What do you think about that?
Well, it's really undeniable. Really, it's not all gang violence. I mean, the cops tend to say that about half the murders are caused by gang violence, but a lot of it is the presence of guns and people getting on the street, getting used to using them to solve any conflicts, Jeremy.
And what about, Chip, this news today, and well, actually yesterday, but it's sort of making the headlines today, that Chicago's new police superintendent has filed charges to dismiss five of the officers involved in the Laquan McDonald shooting, including Jason Van Dyke, who was the officer who fired all 16 shots into McDonald. He's already been charged with first-degree murder. But how has the city's handling of the Laquan McDonald case affected police relations with the community?
Well, it led to this video came out last November, and it led to the first political crisis that Mayor Emanuel has faced. He fired his police superintendent. He fired the head of the agency that investigates the most serious police misconduct. The Department of Justice came in and started an investigation that could lead to all sorts of court ordered changes. And the mayor himself appointed a panel to study police accountability. And that led to a whole raft of recommendations a few months ago, Jeremy.
So when it comes to the violence in Chicago, is there anything that people are saying that the city should be doing that they're not already to try to make sure that September isn't even worse than August?
Well, lots of different ideas. We're hearing calls for a massive show of force in neighborhoods to bring in the county sheriff's officers, Illinois troopers, even the National Guard. We're hearing pleas to resurrect a program that enlists former gang members and ex-convicts to intervene in conflicts that can lead to shootings. And, Jeremy, we're hearing calls for the city to revamp its community policing program to do a lot more to rebuild trust and basic communication with folks in the most violent neighborhoods.
That's Chip Mitchell, who is West Side Bureau Chief for WBEZ in Chicago, talking with us about what has been the deadliest month in Chicago in almost 20 years. Chip, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young.